Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solaria Report. It's time for the first quarter wrap-up, news, trends, and stories, and I'm joined by Dr. Joseph Farrell. We had a great conversation with the Clash of Civilizations, our main theme last week, and this week we're discussing the news, trends, and stories. Joseph, welcome to the Solaria Report.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me back.
Every quarter, it gets harder and harder to call the stories down to a manageable size.
Yep.
And it's simply explosive. If you look at the stories, you know, it used to be we would live in a world where there were one or two stories a week that I thought were important. You know, now there's one or two a day that I think are important. And some days there are, you know, four or five.
Yep.
Anyway, we talked about the U.S. economy a lot last week, and so I want to, we have six areas that we cover. The first is finance, is the economy and financial markets. The second, geopolitics. The third, culture. The fourth, science and technology, and then unanswered questions, and finally, inspiration. But last week, because we discussed the new administration and what's going on in the economy, we covered a lot of those topics, and there's
right.
a detailed list of stories in the, on the web presentation, and I'm not going to go through all of it, but I thought maybe we could just touch on some of the highlights, because what we're seeing with the change in the politics and the change in the direction of government, we're seeing some real changes, and I just want to touch on some of them. One is the fact that we're watching pension funds really start to have to face up to the day of reckoning. We're starting to see more and more pension funds admit that they can't make their benefits, or municipalities and state government say
yes.
that they're going to have to start raising taxes or doing other things to meet their obligations.
Right.
So the day of reckoning is really upon us. Another one is we're really starting to see an acceleration of the what I call global 2.0 economy fail. I think we're expecting 3,500 store closings in the first quarter
yes.
within the United States economy. And so we're really seeing the reorganization of retail and the demise of the people who haven't made the shift to a more online economy. So,
right.
But the big one, as you know, is what I call the debt growth model is over. And we're just beginning to see people realize what that might mean. So I'd like to ask you to comment on that. How do you think the debt growth model being over is showing up?
Well, it's showing up not only, as you pointed out, in the pension fund issue, it's showing up in the war on cash. But to me, the biggest way it's showing up is people's reactions to it. And this, again, takes us back to what we talked about last week. President Trump has to articulate as part of his, you know, what we've been calling philosophical cultural vision. He also has to articulate the fact that we are moving through a major paradigm shift in the way global finance is organized and arranged. And that
right.
he has to articulate this fact very, very clearly, that the debt growth model is over. And now, and this is important for him to do, because thus far, the only world leader that we have seen that has come right out and said this is the German finance minister, Schäuble. If Trump
right.
does it, if Trump does it, it can become a part of a discussion that people need to be made aware of how this is going to affect their personal finances, their local state government finances, or provincial finances, and so on and so forth. This needs to be done by some leader of one of the major economic powers. And I think, Catherine, just kind of, you know, you and I have been following this for so long, you certainly far longer than I. What I think we've been looking at the leaders of the G20 and the G8 and so on, none of them are wanting to do this themselves. I think they've been kind of waiting for the United States to take the lead here, which, again, it would have to do. But what you're talking about with the pension funds, the war on cash and everything, this is not something confined to the United States. It's in almost every Western, it's in every Western nation. So he needs to take the bull by the horns, I think, and just articulate those general points so that the discussion can start to be had. And again, you know, these are problems that are not going to find a, in my opinion, a centralized Mr. Globalone solution. Every country is different. Every country is unique. Within each of those major economic powers, there are regional differences and so on that have to be taken into account. So in other words, there's not going to be any solution coming from the CFR or the Economist or what have you. The solution is going to have to be found by including people in the discussion, and the discussion can't be had unless a leader stands up and says, we need to have this discussion. I think this is step one, because if we don't have the discussion, Catherine, we're just kicking the can, and sooner or later the system implodes, and no one has any idea why it imploded or what we can do about it. And none of us want to be in that situation. So again, you know, this is a perfect opportunity for Trump to take the bull by the horns, exercise some cultural leadership as well as political leadership, and say we need to have this discussion. And it needs to be an open one. It can't be behind closed doors, Mr. Rockefeller or Mr. Rottenchild having their, you know, their usual their usual tricks that they play. It has to because
did you see the little informal clip that Lord Rothschild got in his latest interview? I think it was on Bloomberg, where essentially he intimated we needed a constitutional convention.
Oh, jeez.
The American system no longer worked, and so we really need, you know, to get a new system here.
Well, you know, constitutional conventions aside, we've discussed the dangers of that in the previous session, but
right.
It is true systemically that there are problems. You know, I don't think moving to cashlessness is the solution, because the only thing that does is it ultimately is going to drive the emergence of local currencies, and there's going to be much more chaos than they bargained for. You know,
well,
we're hearing about
your economy has a negative return on investment on the government money. A
right.
war on cash allows you to keep that negative return going for longer by liquidating portions
right.
of the population, you know, their financial wealth.
Right.
So
ultimately,
it extends the game even longer. Right.
But ultimately, it doesn't work out, because what happens when people realize what's going on is they create currencies themselves. And I suspect, you know, we are not being told the whole story about what's going on in India. I suspect that you've already had this phenomenon emerging in that country. So, you know, this is not a long-term solution. And again, that's something that he can articulate. You know, cashless systems, we're going to trust these people that spy on us, and, you know, supposedly the Russians have hacked our elections. So just how secure are these systems? You know, you've raised this point numerous times. You've raised it again in this quarterly wrap-up. Do we really want to trust these systems? Well, my answer is no. You know, I want to have the freedom to take my Andrew Jacksons and my Alexander Hamiltons to a store and spend them. You know, that's the bottom line for
well,
me.
Well, that's why, as part of the war on cash, what we're seeing is Arizona, Utah, a whole series of states moving to create gold depositories or make it possible to do things with gold and silver.
Yep.
I think they clearly see the handwriting on the wall, and in fact, we see Moscow and Beijing getting up to bypass the dollars, you know, with a shift to a gold trade. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, the world clearly sees where this is going. One thing, we talked last week a lot about the military strategy and the sort of reinvention of the national security state. We didn't really touch on the central bank. And this has been the first quarter the Fed, again, bumped the Fed fund rates 25 basis points, indicated that they were going to do the same several more times this year, possibly. Trump has left the central bank alone. Now, because his support, from everything I saw, came from the military intelligence side, to me, it's more important he reinvent that side with his
yes.
supporters and get on strong ground there before you deal with the Fed. But ultimately,
right.
the Fed's going to have to be dealt with. And
yeah.
now they've finished shooting most of their bullets, so I can see why, you know, you would go easy in the beginning.
A step was taken in the Senate, I think, just recently passed a bill to audit the Fed. Now, whether that turns
right.
out to be a real audit or just a whitewash remains to be seen. But it's an important step simply for putting the whole idea on the table. And, you know, getting back to this cashless society business, if you want to hand even more power over to a central bank, that's the way to do it. And, you know, like you, I think several states are seeing the handwriting on the wall. And let's point out something, Catherine, that's very important for people to understand. And that is, with these states moving towards the creation of state bullion depositories, what are they actually saying? Well, they're saying the debt growth model is over. They're saying the equity capital model is the way
right.
to go, because silver and,
right.
and gold are obviously an equity position, if you look at it in a certain sense. So this is what they're really saying, you know, and this goes not only directly to the heart of what we're facing in this country, as far as I can tell, but also in Europe as well. Because thus far, you know, you've had a central bank-imposed currency with the euro. It's not working out too well. The Brits found that out the hard way. And you've had moves towards cashlessness now in Europe taking place. And again, the only thing this is going to do, you can't have a cashless system in Europe and Moscow and Beijing trading in gold on bilateral currency arrangements. You know, it's not going to work. So they've either got to figure out a way to get Russia and China under their thumb, which, you know, good luck with that, guys. But this is the problem. And it's going to create, pardon me, it's going to create the same thing in Europe that I suspect is already going on in India. You're going to have the emergence of states taking, you know, their own course of action. Damning Brussels or Berlin or Paris, they're going to do what's good for the economy. Pardon me. So, yeah, I think this whole thing, if the globalists keep doing this, Catherine, it's going to blow up in their faces. This is the big problem. And I don't know about you, but I don't think they realize how big of an explosion that could be.
I don't think they realize, and I think they're going to keep pressing this as hard as they can.
And, yeah, unfortunately,
you know,
I agree with you.
They're going to use the Bitcoin crowd to try and make this fashionable and groovy.
Yep.
So, you know, they're going to have the freedom fighters stalking for them.
Yep.
One of the things, I've been in Europe now for 4 or 5 days, and, you know, it's very clear from the election results in Austria, then the Netherlands, and now where things look like they're going in France. It looks pretty clear that, at least for 2017, the European Union and the euro are going to hold.
Right.
You know, Le Pen wants to renegotiate. She doesn't want to exit.
Right.
So, you know, and it doesn't look, to me, right now, it doesn't look like she's going to win anyway. So whatever happens, I think the European Union and the EU is going to hold. But clearly, the folks here, the frustration is very, very great. And the question is, can they get the EU to really change how they're doing things? It's interesting, when I was I flew into Brussels and took the train out to Bruges, and on the way we stopped in Brussels at the end of the day picking up all the commuters. And about 50 people got on the train car that I was in, and I've never seen an unhappier group of people. So one thing I will say is the bureaucrats at the EU have gotten the message that Europe is unhappy with all the rulemaking.
Well, yeah, and it's the same regulatory climate, you know, that the Trump administration has been dealing with over here. The problem in Europe is even worse, because the European Union really isn't
right.
You know, it's just a big bureaucracy. That's all it is. And the people have little to no input or say in it. So, yeah, the European Union may survive another year, but I don't think it's going to survive in its current form. And the reason why is it has, again, it has run roughshod over the natural national cultures. And, you know, a Frenchman is not going to want to see the death of France in the name of some, you know, some utopian ideal that is clearly not working. And the same goes everywhere else in Europe. One of the things I think with regard to the EU that we also need to pay very close attention to is that some countries in Europe now have begun investigation of Mr. Soros and the wider phenomenon of so-called non-government organizations. Italy is launching an investigation of his connection to the fleets that are, you know, quite literally smuggling immigrants into Italy. I think this is going to spread. Italy, you know, it was one thing for Hungary to do this. It was one thing for Macedonia to do this. But it's quite another when Italy gets on board. And that's going to spread. That's going to spread.
Well, this is important because if you look at the Soros effort, it was part of an effort to ensure that we had the higher moral authority.
Right.
And when the higher moral authority is shown to be essentially lawless,
right,
and it brands us as a criminal, I don't think most people understand how expensive that's going to be on the national stage. And if you look at the media attacking Trump, I think they do know how expensive it's going to be on the national stage or the international stage. That's why they're attacking. I don't know if you noticed, but the LA Times yesterday or this weekend had an editorial that was most, it was very cleverly crafted. And basically they were attacking Trump for ignoring the rule of law. And I thought, you know, the LA Times, the people who made South Central LA safe for CIA narcotics trafficking and made Hollywood safe for pedophilia is lecturing Donald Trump about the rule of law.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
It's quite remarkable, but I think they understand the danger of what could happen if the truth, is revealed.
Yeah, I don't think any reform in Europe is going to make this whole thing go away. I really don't.
No.
It's going to spread, and if the EU survives, it will be in a very, very different structure. That's coming down the pike.
Right. One thing we've seen, and I want to make sure we note in this first quarter wrap up. We've seen real signs that inflation is picking up.
Yes.
And even if you look at the official statistics, they're showing increases in inflation. And, of course, I believe the real rate of inflation is much higher, you know, than the official statistics. And I think one of the challenges for the leadership, both in Europe and the United States, is, you know, if inflation is this strong with commodity prices still low and even falling and energy prices this low, you know, that's going to be a very tricky situation, you know, now that you're turning around and saying, well, you know, we can't fulfill our promises on health care and we can't fulfill our promises on the pension, but we are going to raise your food prices. And I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing the Trump administration give tremendous stress on doing everything they can from a regulatory or other standpoint to bring the energy price down.
Right.
And I think because there's real concern about what could happen to prices and anything they can do to bring down the energy price, they're going to try and do. And that includes the question, will they bring out any of the breakthrough energy technologies?
Yes.
Circumstances may force that.
Well, I think to a certain extent we saw some of the hints of that during the campaign itself. You know, shortly before the campaign, we had the Rockefeller Foundations divesting themselves of petroleum. And to me, that was a huge clue that, you know, something is afoot in terms of energy. We've been seeing more and more stories about success in this fusion experiment and that fusion. I think something is afoot. I think their problem is the same as it's always been, Catherine. How are they going to manage the transition in as unbumpy a fashion as possible? That's their biggest problem. Right now, you know, if you have $250,000, you can go out and buy one of Elon Musk's cars. But obviously not all of us have $250,000 to invest in a car. So, you know, I'll stick with gasoline for now. Thank you very much. But you know, this is their huge problem. And again, this goes back to what we talked about last week. Trump needs to understand that his role is not simply as president of the United States, you know, which he has stated very explicitly. He needs to understand that he is the leader of a civilization and a culture that's going through a profound transition, and he needs to step up to the plate and start articulating these things openly.
Right.
And that needs to be on his agenda, too. You know, it's interesting in Trump's case that he alone, of all the presidents that we've had, could be in a position to do that and talk about hidden technologies and different energy technologies, because his uncle was a physicist at MIT and was involved in some classified studies of Nikola Tesla. So, you know, he's in a very unique position with respect to that. People can go online and Google. My friend Walter Bosley wrote an interesting blog about that relationship between Trump and his uncle and the possibilities of hidden technologies. So yeah, this is another area that he needs to articulate and step up to the plate and get the discussion going in the mainstream.
Right. One of the phenomena we've seen in the economy, and I think it's so important, because if you look at how financial markets have been managed to the extent they have, a lot of it's been done with a variety of corrupt practices, including control files. And, of course, we've seen, and we talked about the explosion of the pedophilia, but I think one of the things that's important to understand is, you know, every business tries to grow, and we've now seen criminality and corruption grow as a business steadily for many years. And the more it grows, the stronger it gets, and, of course, it's really been empowered by the absence of integrity in the digital systems. And it seems to me, somehow, in watching the headlines in the first quarter, America is finally getting educated
to
the problem of a group of people controlling, you know, basically having one expert called surveillance capitalism. When you give a group of capitalists, you know, open-ended access to every ounce of data about all of us, and they are free to act above the law, what you're going to get is you're going to get an out-of-control criminal enterprise. And it's very funny. I was in USA Watch shows, and Greg Hunter said, don't you think, you know, we need to be really afraid of a police state? I said, no, I think we need to be afraid of, you know, digital and financial anarchy by a criminal industry.
You know, he just signed this bill, which is one of his big misses as far as I'm concerned, allowing internet service providers to sell your search history data. That was a big miss. That was
slap him.
That was huge, you know.
Yeah.
Well, again, I don't know, but you know, that was a huge, huge, you know, strike as far as I'm concerned. We already have enough of this stuff. We don't need to be handing these people even more power, because, again, you know, what this ultimately does is it's going to undermine the growth and progress of that technology, because people will minimize, the smart people will minimize their exposure to it. I've certainly done that in the past few months, and I've even gone so far, Catherine, as to buy things online that I don't really need or want, that I might do or use down the line, just to throw anybody that's watching me off the path of what I'm really up to. You know, it's going to get that deviant. I'm you know, and again, I'm responding to a market condition. So multiply that across the board. You have more and more people withdrawing from these things rather than employing them. And, you know, they're cutting their own throat with all of this stuff, is my point. And it goes back to the centralization model. When these people plunder enough, they realize that sooner or later there's nothing left to plunder, and then they start plundering each other. And that's when things really start breaking down.
Well, that's my fear, that this turns to you know, piratization.
Right.
Because I don't think the criminal enterprises we're dealing with are sufficiently self-aware to course correct.
Yes,
so
exactly.
They will absolutely, you know, they're scorpions. They will, you know, they will drown in the middle of the river because they couldn't stop from stinging the frog.
Right.
I would say one of the greatest concerns I had in the first quarter was the legislation now pending in California to allow telcos to implement 5G with tiny antennas that they can literally put anywhere they want, you know, 3, 5 a block, including on your house. And the local officials can't stop it or say anything about it.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, what we saw with the legislation on the ISPs is the same thing we're seeing in this legislation, which is, if you think you're afraid of the NSA, where do you get a load of AT&T?
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, we're watching the private telcos, you know, with the bit in their mouth. And if you look at what's possible in terms of mind control with 5G, it's very, very dangerous.
Yes, it is. I totally agree with you there. It's giving them entry to your mind. And this, again, people have to understand, and Catherine, I honestly don't think people yet understand that these technologies of mind manipulation actually exist and have existed for quite some time. This to me is a very, very draconian situation out in California, or as I prefer to call it now, Nuttyfornia. You're seeing the one party rule there come home to roost, and it's going to get much worse and much crazier.
Right. Well, the funny thing, one last thing before we leave the economy, you know, the stock market just keeps going up. And
yes.
If you look at the divergence between the stock market going up and where earnings or any of the fundamentals, there's an excellent article in The Economist in the first quarter called Multinationals in Retreat. It was about how the local competition everywhere is making it very difficult for the multinationals to hold market share, particularly in the emerging markets.
Yep.
And they're pulling back, they're retreating, and part of it is because centralization. You know,
yep.
As we said, centralization overextended, and it overextended because government debt growth was financing too much of it. So now we're, you know, the local guys are getting smarter, and the debt growth model's going away.
Yep.
But the stock market just keeps climbing. I think part of it is, many investors don't understand the power of what regulatory relief can do, both for people's vigorish as well as for the economics. So I think I think clearly that regulatory relief is a bigger impact or value than people understand, because I have a very good sense of how much value, you know, over-regulation has destroyed. But
absolutely.
I have to tell you, I take it as a sign that Mr. Global is absolutely committed to moving the model to an equity model and will step in and subsidize the equity markets no matter what.
Well, they're going to have to in a certain sense. Yeah, they're going to have
to
in a certain sense, Catherine, because I'm seeing kind of the same thing with the move to doing business locally and regionally. In other words, doing business away from the big conglomerate global corporations. You know, I buy a lot of books, and if I have the opportunity, I avoid buying them from Amazon at every opportunity if I can. It's a conscious decision on my part, because number one, I don't want to feed Jeff Bezos and his crazy ideas. But, you know, more and more people, I think, are going to start doing this, because the local businessman can respond to your particular needs much faster now with the internet. You know, everybody, the thing about the Internet of Things is we tend to think of it as being the big corporations. You know, we tend to think of Amazon and all of these corporations with the Internet of Things, but that's not necessarily the case, because everybody now doing business has a website, and you can quite literally do business with somebody that's local and not part of a chain with just a little bit of search effort. And ultimately, that's a much more responsive entrepreneurial environment to the customer than the big corporation is.
Right. Well, let's turn to geopolitics.
All right.
And I, you know, one of my favorite books, I did a book review of Patrick Wood's book, Technocracy Rising, which
right.
is a remarkable book and describes the extent to which the leadership, you know, sort of the G7 leadership has tried to convert us to a society, an economy run by rules as opposed to markets and price.
Right.
And for those of us who live in a world where price is the great communicator, it's been
yep.
basically driving us crazy. And
right.
And now we are seeing a real pushback against that and an effort to try and destroy the rules-based economy, including, you know, the destruction of small businesses and farms. And here's my question for you, Joseph. We have a leadership trying to destroy small business and farms, and yet they're automating with robotics in a manner that says there will be no employment unless, of course, it's created by small business and farms.
Yes.
There's a deep double bind going on in this. You know, unless the plan is massive depopulation, it doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. It's and even the depopulation is going, you know, if that's their game plan, again, they're not thinking. They're just not thinking. Because you're ultimately going to be dependent on a tradition or craft of people that can fix and repair things. You can't rely on robotics to replace all these jobs. And ultimately, again, Catherine, I think there's going to be a human response to this that they're not taking into account. I think you're going to see people moving away from supporting those companies and so on that are going all robotics. You know, I'm to the point that I no longer shop at Walmart if I can avoid it, because of their attempt to replace human cashiers or people with these self-service checkout things that are being overseen by one overworked person trying to deal with 15 computerized cash out lanes that have all crashed or had some problem. Sooner or later, people are going to quit going to those places to shop because of the inconvenience of it. And to me, I'm in agreement with you. I think they're creating a double blind here that they haven't thought out, you know. And I realize that puts me in opposition to people that think these globalists are super criminal masterminds that have every detail plotted out. I don't think that they're that at all. I think that fundamentally, and I've said this many times, I think fundamentally these are stupid people, because they've been following their own playbook for so long they cannot think in any other way. They've boxed themselves in.
It's the same thing, though, because I occasionally I go back and spend time in that world.
Right.
And here's what I see. I see very, very intelligent people who've worked very hard to get to where they are.
Right.
And they can't fathom that they're clueless about
right.
their world.
Yeah.
So, for example, you get a very successful person, you know, a senior executive in Silicon Valley, and they have
right.
not a clue that Silicon Valley was created by the government.
Right.
The government transferred technology in at low price or for free. The government went around America selling drugs and raising capital that was poured into Silicon Valley. So their capital is deeply subsidized. Their technology is deeply subsidized. And
right.
they don't know that. And you know, I look at them and I see myself 20 years ago. In 20 years ago, I was way too busy doing what was in my faith to not sit down. And now, I've grown up in a poor neighborhood, so I had a pretty good insight into the covert side. But these are people who lived above ground in Disney World, and they don't know that a below ground is happening that's engineering all of it. And
well,
part of it is because they're so busy living based on rules, they can't see the price. They can't see how the money works.
Well, yeah, and part of this goes back to the culture thing again, Catherine. What has happened academically over the last 100 to 150 years is you've had the transformation of the academy into a licensing bureau where you get a license to practice a certain discipline and nothing else, and that's all you're exposed
right.
to. And what we've lost is the tradition, and again, it's a cultural tradition. We've lost the idea of the generalist, of the liberal arts person that thinks across several disciplines at the same time. And this is particularly true, I think, in places like Silicon Valley, where you are surrounded with people that have certainly a brilliance in a very narrow technical field. But ask them to think in broad general terms, this they cannot do. So again, part of the fault, I think, goes back to culture, and part of the fault, therefore, goes back to education and how it's been transformed from something designed
right.
to hand down a tradition to something that is nothing but a licensing agency to go out and practice a certain narrow little thing. So again, for me, I think a lot of this stupidity that you see on the part of the technocratic elite is genuine stupidity because they have not been exposed to anything else in their entire life.
They've been living in a bubble and they don't know they're in a bubble.
Right, precisely. Precisely.
They can't see outside the bubble. And that's one of the things I said in the article I wrote right after the election called The Productivity Backlash. I was sitting in Ireland having breakfast, reading all, I had like 10 European papers stacked up, and I was reading all the coverage, and I realized they have no idea what happened and why. And that's why I wrote the Productivity Backlash, to explain the economics of it. And one of the things I said is, you can have an IQ of 150 in Silicon Valley, but in fact, you are more stupid than somebody sitting in the middle of the heartland with an IQ of 103 who's had to sell it for more than it cost them to make it in a free market for the last 50 years.
Yep, exactly.
That person has so much more intelligence about how the world works than somebody who's been living in La La Land. And that's,
right.
I think it's very hard for all those unbelievably smart people to see that. And I know, you know, I had to look in the mirror and say, I'm the patsy. I know how hard it is to go through that process, and I had enormous incentive to go through it. So it's in a sense, it describes what's going to have to go on in America. Well, but let me touch on a couple of other things. One great interest of yours, and something you've gotten me very not just interested in but educated to, is education, and we clearly see a change in what's happening in education in the United States. We have a new Secretary of Education who has come out against Common Core. But we also know we have the businesses moving in wanting to take over education and turn it into something which literally supports a very inhuman vision of the world. So give us just your perspective on what you think is happening in the world of education.
Well, what's happening with Common Core is precisely more of the same on steroids. In other words, the whole point of Common Core, you know, Gary Lawrence and I wrote the book Rotten to the Common Core, and in it we pointed out it's not the problem that most people have with Common Core is they're dealing with the wrong issue. It's not a new idea to have a Common Core or canon of standards of academic disciplines that one learns and then seeks to pass down. That's not the problem. The problem with Common Core is the assessment process. Because what the assessment process was designed deliberately to do back when they first started using standardized tests on the national level was this for them was a means of first of all, identifying and tracking the more gifted students. And of course, we pointed out that there are problems philosophically even with that whole notion and the standardized test. But this was their goal, was to identify and track gifted individuals who would then be shunted aside into special programs. So in other words, they abandoned the idea initially with the idea of creating a public education system that would elevate everyone to the degree that their potential allowed them to be elevated. They were simply looking for gifted people. So in other words, what they did is they set up a system that was designed to track you. And Common Core now takes this whole standardized testing notion and expands it all the way from kindergarten to the end of high school. And they want to extend it beyond that. And the reason why is they want to steer you into, you know, we can hear the euphemisms now, into your life career opportunities and all of this stuff. And eventually, of course, if you decide to do something else other than what's indicated on your test scores, they will probably penalize you financially if you decide that you want to do this and not that. So the whole system is a huge scheme of extending this idea that the academy is not there to hand down a cultural tradition, be it in literature, the arts, or the sciences, or what have you, but really is a licensing bureau. You go get your degree, and this is what you're licensed to practice and have authoritative opinions on. And that's the problem. It's extending the whole idea that we have with the standardized testing business of these tests being really nothing but to test your loyalty to certain narratives. And that's the problem. So Common Core, as far as I'm concerned, you know, not only does Common Core need to go, but rather the whole system. I'm in the John Taylor Godwin right. camp here, Catherine. The whole system needs to be scrapped. And by the whole system, right. I mean teacher certification, the whole nine yards. It's a crime, and I've always viewed it this way. You know, I've got a PhD from the oldest university in the English-speaking world, for crying out loud. I can't teach history to high school because I don't have a teaching certificate. And after having observed firsthand the nonsense that's taught in those courses, I wouldn't want to get one. I value my mind and its ability to think critically too much to subject it to that nonsense. So the whole system has to go. It's just an extension of the academy as a licensing bureau. It's nothing more. It's quite frankly, Catherine, it's fraudulent to call it academics anymore because it isn't. It isn't at all.
Right. Well, it's so painful to talk to professors or teachers who are struggling within the system.
Oh, yeah.
And you see same thing that you see with healthcare.
Yes.
You know, I've always said to you that if we wanted the healthcare system to work, what we should do is just announce that the federal government is out completely,
yes.
including regulation, and we're going back to a system of paying cash.
Yes.
And once we all got over the shock, within 5 years, it would be remarkable how well it was working.
That's exactly the system I grew up with as a little boy. My parents paid cash, and if they couldn't afford it, they worked out a payment plan with the doctor or the dentist. That's exactly how it worked.
He used to get paid with chickens and eggs. So, I remember.
Well, here's the other thing about Common Core. You know, I have several members in my website that are teachers in the public school system. And almost to a man or woman, they're telling me, you know, these nightmarish stories of what they're having to put up with. And you and I both remember at the crowdfund kickoff party, we had a teacher present who had retired after, I think, a quarter of a century as a teacher. And she said that the reason that she did that was that the Common Core was forcing her to use a standardized lesson plan. Now, if you can imagine imposing a lesson plan on a teacher at a national level without any real direct or human connection with the students in her classroom that she has to deal with on a day-to-day basis, this is complete lunacy. And it's also, if you'll notice, another centralized solution, and it's another inhuman solution, because it's not taking into account Yeah, it's not taking into account the individuals that she had to deal with. So, you know, part of the art and craft of being a teacher is you have to.
If you have a 5G system up and everybody chipped, including
right.
the parents.
Right.
So if everybody's chipped and mind controlled, and if they don't behave, their money's turned off.
Right,
then
exactly.
you're going to have zombies, and it should work for zombies.
Oh, of course. That's the goal. Again, it's you
right.
know, we're going to slot you into this life career choice or that life career choice, and if you don't go along, yeah, you face a financial penalty. That's the goal. So the whole system, as far as I'm concerned, Catherine, needs to be scrapped, and people have to just start standing up, and we're reaching this stage, are going to have to start standing up and saying, no, I refuse to go along with this.
No. Right. Well, and I think the reason I keep coming back to these points, Joseph, is I think it's easier to do it once you understand that the end goal is inhuman.
Yes.
And once you understand that at least we have a group of people in the White House who are against inhuman and are trying
right.
now
right.
imperfectly, as the,
sure,
as the latest telecom victory will underscore. But I think when if you understand where this is really going, you get your vigorish up a lot faster.
Yeah.
One of the things I didn't mention, and it crosscuts between politics and economy both, is we're coming up into another debt limit,
right.
and that's going to have to be dealt with. So that's a sort of extra budgetary process. Who knows when the government runs out of money, but we could have trouble as soon as the end of April and anywhere
yep.
into October. And we see no inclination in Congress to reach the kind of consensus we need to make sure that that's properly taken care of. And
right.
I'm curious to know what you think might happen.
At this point, Catherine, it's hard for me to guess, because it seems like there's really no interest in Congress in the old gentlemanly art of genuine discussion and compromise. And I say that as much about the Republic thugs as I say it about the dummy crooks.
Right,
It's ridiculous. And, you know, if they end up blowing up the government, I think there's a certain segment of society that would say, good. I honestly don't know how to predict that one. I'm at a complete loss.
One of the things David Stockman has suggested, that is, in certain circumstances, if they do stall, it will give Trump basically dictatorial powers to do the equivalent of wide end of veto spending.
Yep. Yep.
So he could just start doing some very creative change inside of all of that.
You know, this discussion about line item veto has been had for years, and again, they could create the crisis of opportunity to finally implement it, which I think is long overdue. But again, here's another issue that Trump could take it right to the American people and say, this is out of control. Congress is not abiding by the Constitution. I need the authority for line item veto. And of course, you know, that's another blow against Mr. Global and the scheme that's gone on in Washington, D.C. for so long. But it would clean things up in a hurry, regardless of who was president.
The danger is if Trump's budget looks anything like its blueprint, he's proposing to violate the Constitution, because he's proposing...
Yeah.
that we give a $50+ billion increase to an agency which is operating out of, in violation of the Constitution on a clear and open basis.
Right.
So,
exactly.
You know, make no mistake, Congress for 20 years has been appropriating to agencies who are refusing to obey the law.
Yeah. Yeah, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. You know, it's such a swamp of corruption and fraud that, you know, there may be no way to fix it, and it just has to blow up. I honestly don't know. You know, for several years that was my philosophy. You know, the system, the United States, is like an alcoholic, and it will have to hit absolute bottom before it is able to pick itself up and correct its ways. And that may be the only spiritual course left to us.
Right, and that's one of the reasons I keep trying to focus everybody locally, because this could blow. So we don't know which way it's going to go, and we need to be prepared to be successful either way. Well, let's turn to the shift to the multipolar world, because one of the things that, you know, while the debt growth model was with us, we've lived in a world where the U.S. was basically the global cop. And you could love the system or hate the system, but it assured, you know, like the Roman Empire, it assured a certain amount of order when it came to doing trade and doing business.
Right.
And now we're looking at a world where, if we go out of control, not everybody is going to be superior to the United States.
To
a certain extent, you're going to have a plethora of bullies feeling empowered to try and fill the power vacuum. And that's not a very pretty looking world.
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the idea of the United States as the global cop, because I think in part what we're seeing is the reaction to how bad of a global cop that we have been, particularly since 9/11. If you look just right now at the hotspot in the world where I think you're going to see a real test of multipolarism, and that's the Pacific, and particularly with North Korea. I've been maintaining for a number of years, Catherine, that Mr. Abe's rearmament plan in Japan is because they are seeing the handwriting on the wall that the United States is no longer a trustworthy ally, number one. And after the most recent North Korean thing, Catherine, again, I was absolutely floored. I remember a few years ago when North Korea fired off some missiles over Japan, and I think it was CBS or ABC. I was, you know me, I'm up all night, so I was listening to the radio as I was working. And the Japanese foreign minister, they ran a story that said that he had come out and said if North Korea persists in doing this, it should be warned that Japan can arm itself with nuclear weapons to the teeth in a fortnight. You know, basically, Japan, like Germany, is a turn the screw nuclear power, and put the parts together, and there we go. That story ran once, and it was never repeated that night. Well, the most recent thing that has happened with the current insane occupant in Pyongyang was the same thing. Japan has stated that they are going to, you know, if this keeps up, they're going to have to consider all the options, basically. Now, this is interesting because what it means is North Korea is a destabilizing factor in, number one, China's Silk Road plans. It's a destabilizing factor for Russia, which is very concerned about building up its infrastructure in Siberia and developing those resources there. It's of major concern to Japan for obvious reasons, plus the fact that Japan and Russia have just signed a number of deals for Japanese financing for some of these infrastructure projects. So it's very interesting that even though each of those powers has their own distinct national security issues, that they could be getting together on a solution for North Korea. And it, with those three involved, you would not need the United States. This is the real challenge here, and this is why I said in the first interview that we did last week that I view this whole treatment of Russia and the sanctions issue by Tillerson as a colossal disaster. Because if those powers play their national interest card to their mutual benefit, they don't need the United States in the mix. And that could be a long-term development that, you know, we will come to regret. There's no two ways about this.
Here's the thing. As long as you have a president who's perceived as being unpredictable, that's exactly what's going to happen. All those folks are going to say, we're on our own. What deals can we make?
Exactly.
And that's going to continue to happen. Right.
And precisely. We saw that with the Anshin summit in Japan between Mr. Abe and Mr. Putin last year during the Christmas season. You know, they inked a number of deals and just put aside the whole question of Japanese claims on the Kuril Islands. You know, so they're moving ahead, like it or not. And the reason I pointed this out, Catherine, is I think this is the hot spot over the next several months, and it's going to have a huge impact on the Trump administration foreign policy. But if they don't get their act together, this is going to spill over in Europe, which to a certain extent it's already doing. The way I think personally that he mishandled Chancellor Merkel was bad. You know, don't piss off Germany. Third time's the charm, folks. But you know, the other problem is if you're following what's going on in Europe, and I'm a Germany watcher simply because, you know, it's the strongest economy there. You find a number of state officials in Germany going to Russia and having these meetings with Putin and bypassing Merkel directly, the most recent being the governor of the state of Bavaria, where, you know, Miss Merkel has strong influence in her coalition government from the Bavarian Christian Social Union Party. So, you know, these trips are not taking place without her behind the shut doors connivance and participation. So something, you know, like this in North Korea could spill over very, very quickly into a complete reassessment in Europe of their security arrangements, of their military arrangements, of their economic arrangements. And Catherine, the other thing we need to remember here with the multipolar world, Russia has just finished putting the last pieces into place of its own internal financial clearing system. So with that and the Chinese doing the same thing and making these bilateral gold and bullion and currency arrangements, they're putting into place, while we are talking, they're putting into place the practical steps for an international financial clearing system that completely bypasses the West. And that's another huge foreign policy.
I should point out the Chinese have been launching satellites that work off of quantum computing.
Right, exactly.
So that they can create, because to create an alternative system, you're going to have one that is completely
secure,
immune to hacking. It's got to be secure. And if they can create, if the Russians and the Chinese can create secure satellite information systems, you know, or cables across Eurasia that can't be cut by the Americans, you know, then you're talking about really a serious alternative.
Right.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to bring up, if there's anything that makes me uncomfortable about the Trump administration, it's the love fest with Israel.
Yes.
We had seen the Obama administration burnt enough times by Israel that they had finally decided to, you know, part company or certainly there was space in that alliance.
Yes.
And we're seeing that reversed under Trump. What do you think that means in terms of policy in the Middle East going forward?
Well, on the one hand, I'm not terribly concerned for the simple reason that Israel represents a cultural outpost in the region that shares at least some of our cultural tradition and values, certainly not all of them. But on the other hand, I'm very concerned with it for the simple reason, Catherine, that there's been this quiet Israeli-Saudi alliance that has been going on, you know, very covertly for quite some time. And to me, you know, to me, the Saudis are just bad news any way you slice them. I just, you know, they have been behind so much mayhem and malevolence, not only in the region but around the world, that any connection with that, I think, has to be reassessed. So I'm with you. I view it with some alarm, not, you know, total alarm, but I view that with some alarm, because the other flip side of that is, too, that both the Saudis and Israelis have been concerned for quite some time about Iran. You know, there was all that war hysteria during the Obama administration, which, thank goodness, he resisted the pressure. you know, I don't say many very good things about President Obama, but that was certainly one of them. That concerns me a great deal, too. you know, Iran is every bit as bad of a regime that Saudi Arabia is. But quite frankly, you know, I just don't think that we have done any good in that region. We really haven't. It's time to cut them loose and let them fight it out amongst themselves, as far as I'm concerned, which they will certainly do from all indications. But I view it with some alarm, Catherine. I really do.
Well, let's turn on to one of the sections in geopolitics we have in these trends and stories is the deep state grows more evidence. And if I was a peanut gallery throwing rocks at the current administration, it happened every time that DynCorp's name came up.
Right.
DynCorp is one of the big military corporations. It traditionally has been the lead contractor at the Department of State. And it was very interesting. I don't know if you realize this, in Rex Tillerson's testimony during his confirmation hearing, he was asked, are you going to keep DynCorp on as a contractor? Because they just lost a huge contract at State and were in the process of appealing that. And he looked kind of taken aback. The question almost was like, well, who's DynCorp?
Right.
And anyway, so DynCorp has been behind a lot of different allegations about all sorts of covert shenanigans, whether it's drugs or sex trafficking. And anyway, so Trump got very frustrated with the intelligence communities and started to talk about sort of a review and reengineering of the intelligence agencies. And instead of waiting for Dan Coats to get confirmed as National Intelligence Director, he started to talk about the possibility of Steve Feinberg coming in, who owns the venture of the equity capital firm that owns DynCorp. But,
jeez.
Oh, talk about the swamp. Here we go. But it looks like Coates has finally gotten confirmed, and hopefully enough of the bureaucracy was able to persuade him that was a pretty dreadful idea. But to show you that everybody has friends, we see Russia turn around the largest Russian bank, hire the Podesta Group to lobby for it.
Jeez. Unreal. Breathtaking.
It is breathtaking.
Well, you know, this goes back to what we said in the first part. The Trump administration has to get a handle on this out of control national security agency. There has to be some way of asserting some transparency over their doings or some oversight over their doings. And quite frankly, Catherine, at this stage, I think maybe the solution is you have to start having some popular oversight in this mix, or at least participating in the discussion on how to fix the problem. The other biggest problem that we have in the deep state, as you have pointed out, is that it is very evident by now that there are factions within that national security community. One faction is going all out with everything that it can to ruin this administration. And somehow a strategy has to be formed to weed out these factions. Now, I'll tell you what faction I think is behind this, and I think that in part is the Israeli-Saudi faction within the national security establishment, even though he's turned, you know, toward them, because that's the faction that has the strongest and closest ties to the neocon and neoliberal groups in the power structure. And that's the problem. You know, quite frankly, Catherine, I'm going to make a very weird prediction here. But we've seen the states in this country, certain states, begin steps towards the creation of these bullion depository banks. I'm going to go on way out onto the end of the twig of speculation here and say that these states are going to do something to try and secure themselves against the national security establishment as well.
Right.
You know, this is an inevitability.
Right.
It hasn't been talked about yet.
They need the citizens to support them in doing that.
Yep.
And, you know, you need a critical number of legislators who do not pine for the truth of the tape one. They need to come to understand that if the system goes to inhuman, they're toast anyway. So there's, you know, the truth of the tape one will do them no good, and they need to get a critical mass. You know, one of the reasons I stayed in Tennessee was the, if you look at the membership of the Tennessee Firearms Association, it's greater than 50% of the voting population. So the people who consistently turn out to vote. Okay, I also wanted to just touch on a little bit on Mexico, because Mexico has really taken a brutal hit financially and economically as a result of the Trump campaign and presidency. Do you think that relationship is going to go back to something more balanced?
That's a hard one to call. I honestly don't know. Currently, I would say no, because you have such backlash from Mexico. Of course, the New York Times, owned by Slim, you know, Mexican billionaire. I don't see that warming up anytime soon. But again, Mexico doesn't need to be an enemy. And this is what I can't figure out. You know, if your concern is about immigration, then we have a lot more in common with the Hispanic European culture than we do with, you know, with most parts of the world. In fact, you know, they represent a certain tradition very solidly within Western culture. So, I'm about culture, because culture ultimately depends and defines the kind of politics that we have. So we've got to do something to fix that relationship. You know, and Mexico has its own domestic problems. You know, it's as corrupt, if not more so, than anything we see in Washington, D.C. So that you know, it's not all on us. In other words, is what I'm saying. It's about a 50-50 split here. But I really hope that we don't see the bellicosity towards Mexico that we've seen thus far. I think that's a huge mistake, because Mexico is kind of a symbol for the whole, you know, Latin world. And the way we treat Mexico is going to rebound against us, or for us, depending on how that works out, in other countries that we cannot afford to lose as friends and allies, you know, Argentina, Chile, Brazil, and so on. You know, we've meddled in their affairs so long that they're sick of it. So, you know, that we don't need to keep alienating people. You know, we've got strong cultural allies, and we need to make use of them.
The last thing I wanted to bring up in the geopolitical area is, if you look at what's happened in immigration, both in North America and in Europe over the last, and to a certain extent Asia, over the last 10 years, and you look at some of the things that could increase immigration and the flow of immigrants, I'm tempted to say there are many scenarios where we ain't seen nothing yet. You could be looking at much greater, if you look at sort of the devastation wrecking in the Middle East, you could be looking at much greater immigration into Europe, or much greater pressure for immigration into the United States. And so we're seeing a tremendous backlash against it, but a backlash is not the same as moving expeditiously to create the conditions precedent where massive migration may not happen. And that, of course, leads us into the question of what in the world is the global spring, and what in the world are they doing with the weather?
Well, again, this, you know, our foreign policy in the Middle East has been an absolute disaster in this regard. The backlash, the immigration crisis that it's created in Europe, you know, we didn't think out anything, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I blame the Bush administration for that, because that whole policy of adventurism was just not very well thought out. And, you know, part and parcel of that policy was you couldn't say anything critical about Islam. So, you know,
we're in
a double bind here. This is why I say it's let those people fight it out. And most people don't realize that the division within Islam between Shia and Sunni Muslims is profound and deep and long-standing, and there's been no love lost between those two factions. You know, I'm all in favor of letting them fight it out, you know, amongst themselves, and the rest of us, you know, sit on the sidelines and let them do it. Because as long as we're there, what we're doing is we're uniting things. You know, let it fall apart on its own, as far as I'm concerned. I'm in agreement with you. I think we could be looking at a much bigger immigration problem than we've seen thus far. And again, I make no apologies. The president does have the authority to regulate immigration, and we need to do it. We need to start taking care of our own people that we have here, rather than bringing in more that are, by and large, for the most part, poor people, uneducated, illiterate, growing up in a culture where it's okay to rape women and then blame them for it. You know, it's just, we don't need that. You know, it's a form of cultural suicide that I just do not understand. I have no, quite honestly, I have no time to lend to people that want to defend this practice and argue otherwise. It's suicidal, Catherine. We've seen it in Europe. We're beginning to see it here, and this is another area where I think we have to be very careful about Latin America, because if there is a part of Western culture that is going to defend itself against that sort of thing, it will be there. It will be there.
Well, if anything has driven the success of some of the countries that have practiced it, it has been immigration designed to always attract the best and the brightest.
Right.
So, for example, in the United States, you know, for generations now, I mean, one of the many blessings of World War II was, I mean, do you know the talent that poured out of Europe into the United States as a result of the Nazis and the, you know, you almost makes you wonder.
Yeah.
But we have always been quite clever about attracting, you know, immense talent, whether educated or non-educated, and using them well.
Right.
So, and if you read the long-term projections of whether or not the United States is going to do well, all the ones that project they're going to do well from all those hideous think tanks, basically what they're betting on is the talent that will be attracted through immigration. That's what they're betting on.
Yeah, but the problem here is that our policy, you know, since we're talking about immigration and Latin America and geopolitics, let's take the Pacific model scenario that we discussed with North Korea and transfer it and translate it, as it were, to Latin America. This country has a long history of meddling in the internal affairs of those nations, and particularly, you know, the major regional powers down there, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and so on. And there, over time, of course, there has built up a tremendous body of resentment, and understandably so. We need to remember that those countries are technologically sophisticated enough that they too can become nuclear powers very easily. Brazil, you know, Germany sold the complete nuclear fuel cycle to Brazil a couple decades ago. It was under the chancellorship of Helmut Schmidt, as a matter of fact. So, you know, they've got the technology to become a nuclear power. So does Argentina. And if you put yourself in the position of countries like that, and they're watching the unipolar American empire starting to crumble, and they're looking at how things are developing in the Pacific with respect to North Korea, They're going to be faced with the same choice. Either they defend themselves and not rely on the big brother up north and have him dictate our immigration policies and so on and so forth. And again, this is a culture we need to understand that will defend itself. Ultimately, if pushed to the wall, it will defend itself. So we need to reassess, in my opinion, Catherine, and we've needed to for a long time. We need to reassess our whole foreign policy approach to Latin America. It is too important to play around with. It's too important culturally. You know, it's an entire continent like ours that is basically an export of Western European culture. And it is, in a certain sense, it's much more aware of that heritage than we are here in this country. So we need to be very, very careful in the way we deal with Latin America.
Right. Well, I think one of the strategies, actually, you know, remember the Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Clinton administration said to me, black people are hopeless, we've given up on them, we're moving them out, bringing the Hispanics in.
Yeah.
I think part of that strategy was designed to create much stronger ties with Latin America at a much more intimate level.
It may have been. It may have been. I don't know how successful it's been. But that, you know, I don't put anything past these people. So it may have been a strategy that they were attempting to try. But again, that, you know, that only indicates, as far as I'm concerned, their moral bankruptcy to begin with. Why would you give up on black people? You know, that's a whole segment of the population that you are basically saying has nothing to contribute. That there's no intellectual creativity there.
If you look at Hollywood, where do you think they're stealing half of their intellectual capital from?
That's true. That's true.
Okay, so let's turn to our third area, culture. And this one, I credit you with really helping me understand how absolutely important this was, because when the whole model changes, you know, you can't rebuild the model. You have to start with culture. You can't start with economy.
Yes.
So, you know, economy is a constraint. It's got to operate in some kind of economic optimization. You know,
right.
But it starts with our culture and it starts with our knowledge. And, right. And so part of the question is, with all the bitterness and frustration and anger that's happening as people push for different, you know, sort of options in the model and propose different models and the current models coming down, how do we nurture and start to build real solutions? You know, if the leadership is basically going to go insane in war all day long, how do we start to, you know, because we, you know, we can't wait for the leaders to find a solution. Their solution, by and large, has been more centralization and more rules, and we can't wait for them. How do we start to rebuild and re-nourish the field and start to look for real options to change, to transform?
I'm glad you asked that, because I've been thinking about this a lot. I think, first of all, you have to identify at your local level or regional level those people that are scholarly representatives of our cultural tradition and that can talk at a deep and detailed level about it. You know, you have Vera, the lawyer that you sometimes interview. It's people like that we need to identify, number one, in our region.
Right.
And number two, make contact with them. Start to hold groups. Get together with friends. You know, it's important to have people of a similar cultural outlook. And start to get together in informal discussion groups. Invite these people to come and start discussing these things. What do we do if, you know, just run through the what-if scenarios, you know, make it a rule that anybody can say anything and it's open discussion. That's number one. I think that definitely needs to be done, because what you're then doing is you're sending a signal to those people that, you know, you mentioned Stephen Cohen here in your written transcript. Precisely. You need to start identifying people like that and, let them know that they're valued, that their opinions are worth something to you. And start creating these matrices of discussion groups. And I know that sounds, for people that want to do something, you know, I know that sounds a little bit passive, but in reality, if you stop and think about it, the American Revolution was formed out of such groups. Unfortunately, the French Revolution was formed out of such groups, and that didn't end up too well. And the same thing with you know, the European Revolution in 1848.
But the point is that they can do something. The French made the mistake of trying to attack Moscow.
Well, yeah, that was a little problem. But the same thing. Just stop and think of, you know, the Wesleys in England. Basically had their little group. But what they did, what that group actually achieved and accomplished, was a massive awakening, spiritual awakening, that ultimately led to the decline of the slave trade and all of the good things that came out of that. So these kinds of groups, believe it or not, are the matrices in which cultural change can be managed if you can keep away the wackos. And that's why I say it's important to identify those people that know the cultural tradition and have a scholarly, detailed knowledge of it and know what to defend and what to critique and so on and so forth. And that cannot be a phenomenon that, you know, you or I could sit down and draw up a litmus test of, you know, who's acceptable and who's not. That's something that has to emerge organically from these groups themselves. We certainly don't want to be inviting people like Maximilian Robespierre, but, you know.
a lot of the greatest scholars of our day have been forced out of the academy.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So they're available.
And those are the people, you need to seek out these people and get in contact. I know exactly what you mean. You know, I'm a victim of that process myself. And you need to identify these people and invite them and, you know, I hate to use that hated word that's so overblown and overused, but nurture them in a certain sense and start discussing these things. And again, it's a matter that you have to inform yourself enough to know kind of basically what it is you or your associates are looking for in this respect. You might be interested in scientific questions or historical questions or sociological questions or the arts or whatever. So you need to start identifying these people and start talking, start having conversations, pull your noses out of your iPads and smartphones and, you know, bring donuts and coffee and folding chairs and sit around and talk.
Well, here's the thing that, you know, part of the reason I've spent as much time on this Awareness Report arguing against the divide and conquer, It's really the lines are human versus inhuman and lawful versus lawless. And those are the two issues that have to be understood. And then the question is how? How do we make sure it's human? How do we build a constituency for lawfulness? You know, how do we do that? And so we have to, all these different divide and conquerors that have put people in different boxes. You know, we have to be prepared to leave those boxes and start organizing. You know, we're for humans and we're for the law. Now, how do we make that happen? So, I agree.
For me, the magic word here that will help guide people, Catherine, is tradition. If you stop and think about the power of that word and how it kind of sums up what you're talking about, we live in a country that basically has kind of an innate anti-tradition tradition, and we need to start criticizing that and recognizing some of the failings as well as some of the good things that that's brought about. But we do have a tradition as well in this country, and you know, we need to view it within the wider context of the evolution of Western culture and civilization, which I don't think we're doing a very good job of. But I do think if people keep that word in mind, they'll kind of be guided naturally.
The other word I think we need to explore is sovereign.
Yes.
And what sovereign means as an individual
Yes.
You know, or a county, or a state, or a country, and
right.
look at all these technologies and the extent to which we are allowing, you know, digital means to destroy our individual and collective sovereignty.
Right. Exactly.
And how we reverse that. Okay. Well,
right.
let's move to science and technology. There's a great deal that we could cover, but I want to focus on just a few things. One of them is this idea that our digital systems have zero integrity.
Yes.
And I keep trying to communicate this, and I'm not sure it's made it through all the way, although I have to say the president not being able to phone a world leader without it being leaked to the press.
Yeah.
has been and his frustration with that situation has been extremely helpful.
Yep.
But I know you've also talked a lot about, you know, the scientific process and peer review and academy also not having integrity.
No,
and
no.
We're watching it, you know, both whether it's the science or the technology, we're watching a significant debasement in terms of what is the truth and also how is it applied? So it's both in the establishing what's true and what's not, and then how is science and technology applied? So, you know, and it comes back to these fundamental issues of, you know, human and lawful.
Right.
But I know my frustration with the debasement in science and technology, I think of it as completely off the charts, but I look at where things are, and I know it has the potential to get much worse.
Oh, it's happening before our eyes. You know, not only are these systems unsecure. I mean, you know, the president can't make a phone call that it doesn't get leaked, and of course, this
yeah.
has to come from leakers. You know, this is the bottom line here. But the other part of the problem, since you're mentioning science and peer review and the broader culture, is again, Catherine, we have a clear example of how massive government funding of big science projects is actually harming the scientific process. Because
absolutely.
Yeah, because again, you have an adherence to an orthodoxy, and then in order to maintain the orthodoxy, you fund certain projects, you publish certain articles in scientific journals, and others never get seen or get retracted at the last minute. And this ultimately shortchanges the scientific project. So let's go back to my discussion groups. One of the things you'll notice about these types of groups throughout history is sooner or later they decide to start publishing informal journals. Okay? And those have been enormously influential, particularly in the sciences over the years. But the other thing that we have to bear in mind, oh, I just lost my point too. Oh, I tell you what. The other thing that we have to bear in mind is that these narratives get reinforced, and they get reinforced.
Right.
And I remembered my point. They get reinforced by what we talked about earlier with regard to Common Core, and this is the idea that your degree now is viewed as a license to practice. Okay. So what we have increasingly is people think they are not allowed to have opinions on certain disciplines that they don't know anything about. In other words, we have, particularly in the sciences, become subject to a huge scheme where arguments from authority close the deal. So in other words, you're a famous scientist, you've got your PhD in, you know, theoretical molecular biology or what have you, and you're asked to make an opinion and close the argument on a national television show. We have to get people out of the habit of mind that just because you have a PhD behind your name doesn't allow you to direct the opinions of others. Everybody is allowed to have an opinion about everything.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean you need
right.
to spend time debating the flat earth theory with flat earthers. You know, I get them all the time asking me to comment. And, you know, that's like arguing with people that think 2 plus 2 equals 5. I just don't bother. But we do have the right to have an opinion about everything. We do not have to be licensed to have an opinion. And it's time for people to start, you know, challenging narratives, even from the famous scientists that fill the blackboards with indecipherable equations and so on and so forth. You do have a right to an opinion. We have to get back to this mentality. And the only way, ultimately, that that will succeed is we have to get back to the idea of education as a tradition and a broad tradition, that it's not a licensure to practice a certain thing and speak authoritatively about it. Once we get that tradition restored, then yes, the idea of speaking authoritatively about a particular discipline that you profess will be restored. But we don't see that now. So that's, we've got a huge cultural task ahead of us. This is something that I don't think people, I'm with you, I don't think people fully understand the depth of what we're getting at here, but it is absolutely crucial.
One of the most exciting things I've seen in the first quarter, and really inspiring, and really hopeful, is you are watching, if you look at all the different places where reality is punching through the official reality barrier, no place has it punched through in the last 3 months the way it's punched through in vaccines. And part of it is you have a couple of unbelievably talented, passionate, hardworking people who just never give up. One being, I don't know if you saw Robert Kennedy's incredible presentation, including the fact, which I hadn't known, that the CDC makes money from its vaccine patents, and big money. So the more people who get certain kinds of shots, the more money they make. You know, they're on the Sheriff of Nottingham model, like the Department of Justice.
Right, exactly.
And, but we've seen Robert De Niro, we've seen Andrew Wakefield and Big Tree and Vaxxed. And we have the Vaxxed bus driving around the country recording case study after case study after case study. And some of these case studies, we had one up about parents who'd had triplets, and they went in the morning, got shots, and by the end of the day, all three kids were autistic.
Yep.
And the doctors tried to tell them it was a genetic, and the doctor threw them out of their practice because they wouldn't get more vaccines for their autistic kids.
Yep.
And, you know, but it's so compelling. And I just think you're really seeing a push through. And they can't, you know, they can't get the genie back in a bottle on this.
No, they can't. Let's do some big scenario connecting here for people.
Okay.
Let's talk about vaccines, relaxation of rules, Elon Musk and his AI chip and body organs.
Oh.
Pardon me, I've got it. Let me take a swig here.
Okay.
Elon Musk has just come out and made an argument that we all need to get chipped, and I can't fathom anybody being this self-contradictory.
Right.
And quite frankly, just stupid. He's come out arguing that we should all be chipped. He's starting a company. And his argument for us doing this is that in order for us to keep up with potential of AI, we're going to have to be chipped and do so in order to keep up with machines. And a few years ago, I think it was just last year or a year and a half ago, he was coming out and saying, well, the danger of AI is that we could create something that would allow, you know, something demonic to come into existence or be kind of gated or transduced into existence through that kind of network. So which is it, Ellen? Are we going to get chipped to have a demonic influence, or are we getting chipped to keep up with the demonic influence? Either way, it seems like a self-defeating enterprise. But here's the problem.
Right.
In following this vaccine story, I put up a number of blogs on my website that They are now developing vaccines that allow them to transmit the vaccine without your knowledge or consent or anyone else's knowledge or consent through normal human contact, like sneezes. So in other words,
right.
You take their vaccine, you sneeze, and whoever inhales your sneeze gets vaccinated about whatever they want to vaccinate you against. Add to this the fact that they are now talking about relaxing the rules for consent, voluntary consent, for human trials of these vaccines, because their reasoning is everybody knows they're safe. Okay?
Right.
So in other words, add that to the mix that they can vaccinate you now without you actually having to get the needle stuck in your arm, and they're planning to relax the rules so that you don't even have to give your personal consent anymore. And let's add in one final thing into the mix. We mentioned this earlier. The son of Senator Ted Kennedy, who is a state senator in Connecticut, wanting to pass a law that the state owns your organs and you have to opt out of that.
Right.
So in other words, they're asserting total control over your body.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, number
and,
one...
And your intellectual content.
And your... Yes, precisely. Precisely.
You're backloading your brain up into the cloud and they
right.
can proceed to, you know, integrate that with their database.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And this is the inhuman agenda. This, folks, this is not only inhuman, it is anti-human. It is against each and every one of us listening to this program, and they need to be told no.
Right.
Pure and simple. I'm not getting chipped, folks. There's little warnings in some ancient writings about that. I don't want your cyborg implant.
It comes back to, because we have two ways to go. If we tear up
right.
the Constitution, it's going
right.
to be very difficult to stop this. You have to enforce the Constitution. You have to back them up on the money now, because ultimately this is going to come down to power and money, and you've got to get the money part of the equation aligned with the legal part. So I hate to sound like the, you know, I hate to beat the drum I've been beating for 20 years, but you got to get the money back.
Yeah, exactly.
You've
got to hold these people accountable.
Right, right.
Because sooner or later, if they're not stopped, it's going to come to open warfare. That's the problem.
Right.
That's the problem.
And I think one of the things that they're not doing it already, if you look at their studying of delivering vaccines by aerosol,
yep.
You know, if they're not doing it already, I think they're close to integrating vaccines in the global sparing.
Yes,
so,
I do
and,
too.
Yeah, right. And that technology also very much dovetails with what they can do with a 5G network. So,
right.
This is coming down to who controls your body, you or them, and your mind.
Yep.
Okay, so let's turn to the unanswered questions. And I know certainly you and I have talked enough about, you know, the government, the mysterious governance system and how it all works. And that's why, you know, I keep telling people, if you haven't listened to Joseph's presentation at the Two Secret Space Program conferences, you really need to listen to them, because you do a marvelous job of talking about what's happening in the financial model and the governance model that would indicate that we're really, you know, we're financing a separate culture or world or off-planet,
yep.
whatever. But we're certainly financing another civilization as well as a breakaway civilization among the humans. So,
right.
But we've seen a couple things develop during this first quarter that kind of inform our conversation. You know, one being that Trump has not put the $11 trillion back on the plate for the budget, which
right.
shows you, for somebody who's as fearless as he acts, it shows you that there are limits to his fearlessness. But the other is we've had more activity going on down in Antarctica.
Oh, boy.
And
yeah.
it raises the question, what in the world is going on in Antarctica? And so you've had a number of stories in the first quarter to contemplate this. Any new thoughts on what in the world is going on in Antarctica?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that is really bizarre. You have a link listed, Antarctica NASA images reveal traces of ancient human settlement. I actually used that story and blogged about it, and then someone sent me an email where the same picture was used a couple of years ago to say that they had radar tomography had found a city under the deserts of Libya and Egypt. And I thought about that for a moment, and I thought, wow, what is going on here? They're telling us they've taken pictures of something somewhere, but exactly where, and why are they taking radar tomography pictures at all? But let's assume, you know, this is always my approach when I take these kinds of stories, because I'm intensely skeptical. I have to be honest with you. I'm intensely skeptical of any story, including photographs of things anywhere, you know, on Mars, on the Moon, in Antarctica. But what's coming out of this, Catherine, is something very bizarre, because that was not the only story where they're alleged to be finding things in Antarctica. There's supposedly pictures of pyramids and so on.
Uh-huh.
And I have to wonder, you know, and plus you've mentioned the story, Antarctica hits a balmy 63.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And I have to wonder, plus the fact you have the Russian Baltic Sea Fleet, you know, going down there again, and you've had all of these strange visitors. So the bottom line for me is they have found something there.
Right.
And my guess is, my best guess is they found either one of two things. They've either found some evidence of civilization that existed on that continent before it became covered in ice, you know, and I've said all along that, you know, if there's one place on Earth where you do have a lost continent of Atlantis buried underwater, that's Antarctica.
Right.
But they've either found something indicating a civilization, perhaps of a technological nature, or, and it could be both actually, they have found another meteorite. You know, Antarctica for some reason seems to attract meteorites from Mars, of all places. And this is going to sound wild and woolly. There are people that speculate that the Earth's rotational axis shifted rather dramatically and suddenly in the mists of prehistory. They don't know exactly why. But if that's the case, it could be that Antarctica at one point was a relatively temporal continent that suddenly got shifted to the South Pole for whatever reason. And if that's the case, then they may have been hit by meteoric bombardment from Mars. And if you recall, back during the Clinton administration, he gave a press conference where he came out and said that they had found a meteorite in Antarctica that apparently had come from Mars that there appeared to be little microbial fossils in. Okay. But what if they found a meteorite, and again, this is all speculation, but there has to be something drawing the likes of the Secretary of State, an Apollo astronaut, the Patriarch of Moscow, not to mention Rudolf Hess and Hermann Göring, you know, decades ago, with their
right.
sponsorship of the Nazi expedition. There has to be something drawing these people down there. What if they found a meteorite that contained portions of something artificial, something manufactured by a technology?
Right.
And what if they were able to trace that meteorite to Mars? You know, it's got to be something
right.
sensational that's drawing all these people there, be it cities sunk under the ice, be it, you know, pyramids that some people claim exist down there, be it meteorites containing, there's got to be something huge. And they're quietly circulating the news amongst themselves. What it may be, I don't know. But that's my best guess, Catherine.
Well, there's something also. We have what is clearly hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions or more, being spent on a global spraying program.
Right.
And that global spraying program clearly has multiple agendas. There are multiple
yep.
things going on. But clearly
yep.
one of the things is weather control.
Yes.
And that's happening at the same time that the poles are supposedly melting.
Yes.
So one question is, are we melting them for a reason? And Because I will say, if you study the corporate documentation and presentations on the natural resources to be had at both poles as a result of the melting, you know, you have a lot of corporate interests licking their chops, waiting to take advantage of that.
Right.
And
right.
That is part of the back and forth about Russia.
Well,
you know, one of the reasons that the leader of Exxon wants to get along with Russia is because that's a very big play.
Yes, exactly. And,
right.
You know, we find Russia with the interest of developing the Arctic. It's interesting that Putin recently went to the Arctic and said, well, there is global climate warming, but it's not got anything to do with mankind. Well,
right.
You know, is somebody else terraforming the Earth then, Vlad? You know, what's the story here? But here's you know, since you mentioned weather modification, and let me just crawl way out onto the end of thy twig of speculation and say, you know, the thought occurred to me that, okay, if you suspect that there's something, you know, truly significant under all that ice, how do you get to it? Well, you melt it. You know, that's the easiest way to do it, and lo and behold, you know, Antarctica, 63 degrees in Antarctica. You know, that's rather balmy. You know, that's, for me, that's shorts and T-shirt wearing weather, folks.
Well, you know the old expression, we'll smoke them out. Maybe we're just going to melt them out.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, but something huge is going on there. I wouldn't even put that scenario, loony as it sounds, past them, because, you know, you're the one that pointed out Lockheed is down there in Antarctica. You know, and what are they doing there?
Right, so this is the one that had me floored. So I took your wonderful post on Antarctica and then I added to it. Because
yeah.
Lockheed, I wrote a post last year that says Lockheed cuts and run, because right before it came out that the $6.5 trillion had disappeared in 2015,
right.
Lockheed spun its IT division,
right.
You know, which presumably has all of those contracts, I'm assuming, out into a company that SAIC had spun out into. So everybody's taking, you know, their liabilities for $11.5 trillion of missing money and spinning those companies out so those liabilities are not on their balance sheet.
Right.
And the company in question, Leidos, suddenly turns up with big contracts in Antarctica. And I said,
yep.
Wait a minute, you know.
Yep.
$11.5 trillion disappears to these entities, and suddenly the entities get reinvented together, renamed, and they're down in Antarctica? This
yeah.
can't be an accident.
No, you know, I again, let me crawl out under the twig of speculation here, because that I've speculated about that too. Why are they there? Well, the first thing I can think of would be it's got something to do with financial clearing. And they need a place where they can possibly send a lot of money off-world for whatever reason without much oversight
right.
from anybody else, and that's a perfect place to do it. Speculation number two is, well, why would Lockheed, of all people, or SAIC, for that matter, be involved with companies in Antarctica? Answer, if you're developing some super secret stuff, the one place on Earth that you could do it relatively securely would be Antarctica, because again, you would have to have nearly 24/7 polar orbital satellite coverage, you know, to see anything going on the surface there. And even then, you know, they're very, very careful about releasing Google images of Antarctica.
Right.
So yeah, something's going on there, Catherine. And
I'm gonna give you a little gossipy tidbit from my deep history. You ready for this?
Okay.
It's 1998. I'm in the middle of a huge food fight. No, I guess it was 97 or early 98. I'm in the middle of a huge food fight on the litigation.
Right.
And all of a sudden, a senior executive at SAIC tries to get me to come with him to their annual meeting and spend a day with SAIC and a big dinner with all their board and everything else. Anyway, so I go, the executive, who was a pretty cool guy, has to go back now. SAIC at the time is the leading contractor, defense contractor, with geographic information systems.
Right.
Remember, I've got Community Wizards. So,
right.
So he has to fly back to California. I get left with a group of guys that were so bizarre and so weird, I thought, I don't care how insulting it is, I'm not staying for dinner. And I just left.
Right.
I just left. Yeah. Well, right after that, they seized the company. Because I know what was going to happen. They were going to try and buy the company.
Yep.
And I just said, I'm not selling Community Wizards to these guys, so, you know, guess what? They just stole it. But,
yep.
I gotta look at that whole world and that whole crowd that night. And when I tell you, this is why we can't let the inhuman happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's no matter how, whatever the disadvantages of being for the human being, because certainly for me there were enormous financial benefits of working for the human being, there is no amount of money that can make it worth it. I'm telling
right.
you, it's just not fun.
No argument from me. No argument
yeah.
from me.
Yeah. Okay, last section, inspiration. So I wanted to find out from you, of all the things that inspired you in the first quarter, what inspired you the most?
I'll be honest with you here. Until I saw your outline, I was struggling to find out something in the news that did. But when I read this article about fellow Texans coming to the rescue after the fire devastates the Panhandle, that was it.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why, you and I discussed this earlier, you mentioned to me the fact that this effort has received no attention from the national corporate-controlled lamestream media.
Right.
And
it's so amazing, Joseph, to see the drivel and the irrelevancy and all the stuff that's pouring out of the shrieking meter, and there you have all these ranchers and livestock and a million acres. That is a huge fire.
Yep.
Dealing with this and not a word. It's like it doesn't exist.
Right.
And it very much, I mean, a million acres and the livestock and the ranches and the businesses, this
yep.
is enormous.
Yep.
Enormous.
Well, the thing that got me about that was inspiring was the fact that it wasn't covered by the mainstream corporate-controlled
right.
media. Because right. if you have a bunch of people banding together to solve a problem without the involvement,
right.
apparently, of the state authorities or of the local authorities and just going out and doing it, that's why they didn't cover it.
It's not just a few people. You're talking about
right.
thousands of volunteer fire people, the
right.
sheriff, the sheriff's office, the ranchers,
right.
everybody working together. One of the ranchers wrote me and said, you know, the popsicle index is still 100% in the Panhandle.
Yep. Well, that's
yeah.
why they didn't cover it, because this was not a centralized government FEMA solution to a problem. This was people saying, forget about the government, forget about the emergency declarations from the governor or the president or what have you. They just went out and did it. And,
right.
you know, we were talking earlier about when you and I were in school, elementary and junior high school, we learned about the old barn-raising parties that people on the frontier back in the 19th century would have. They would get together and build a barn for a farmer in the area. You know, everybody would bring potluck dinner. The men would put up the barn. The women would cook the dinner. The children would play. And at the end of the day, you had a barn.
Right.
And, you know, that was a local solution. Everybody chipping in, buying the materials and so on and so forth. That was a local solution to a local problem. Utterly bypassing, utterly, totally, completely bypassing any government.
Right.
And this is what they've done in the Panhandle. That's why it's not on the news, and that's why it's significant. Because that spirit is still there, number one. And number two,
right.
it shows that people can get together and do things locally And they don't need a permit, they don't need a license or anything of the sort. They just go out and do it. And if the government comes, you know, I can see it now. The government will come along and try and present, oh, you broke this reg and that reg and you're in violation of this and that. And I can just imagine the reaction of those Texas ranchers.
Here's why they can't do it, because the sheriff
right.
are in full support and involved. And as
right.
you know, the federal government can be overruled by a sheriff, so the sheriffs
yep.
are protecting. Yeah.
Yep. Yep, that's perhaps something to discuss with your friend Vera, is the constitutional role of the sheriff, because I
yeah.
don't think most Americans have any understanding of how powerful and essential that office is. But
we
yeah,
have a
this
great
is,
Salieri report. Yeah, we have a great Salieri report with Sheriff Mack called "Who's Your Sheriff?" That goes all through that. It's in the archives. It has a transcript, and I really recommend it to everybody if you haven't
yeah.
read it.
Yeah.
You need to learn about that. It's the other thing I wanted to mention, and I'll bring it up because, you know, I started it and I'm pushing, is last year you gave me permission to start a crowdfund for a virtual pipe organ.
Right.
And Joseph, you know, when I did it, one of the reasons I wanted to do it was, you know, you had persuaded me that what we really needed to do was to preserve and nourish our culture. But
right.
of course, being an investment banker, my second question was, well, what's my action? So I kept peppering you with questions. What about this? What about that? And you were like, oh, God, no. And then I came up with the idea of the pipe organ. Well, you know, it took off. You know, some things just go. They
oh,
just
boy,
go
did it.
Because, oh, unbelievable. But.
I'm shocked.
Well, you know, here's the thing. There's something in the field that wants to happen. And
yeah.
it's happening. The first thing is we all started learning about pipe organs. And then we all started learning about Bach and organ music. And we started thinking about how to become people, instead of operating on one track, operate on 26 tracks.
Right.
And learning about pipe organs and spending more time learning about Bach. You know, I've always listened to Bach, but I haven't really studied Bach. And trying to learn more about Bach, I started to understand how music really can help me deal with the complexity
yes.
and the uncertainty of shifting to a multipolar world. And it's become
yeah.
unbelievably helpful in terms
it is,
of dealing, you know, with unbelievable. And so
yeah, it is.
I now have a rule, you know, I need special permission for myself to listen to something other than Bach, you know, Vivaldi or Italian opera, because if I go listen to the drum beat, I'm saying, you're lowering your mental capacity.
Yeah, it is a multi-track music, and it's very, you know, we have so been dumbed down in our musical listening habits
right.
in the last 50 years.
Right.
With certain pleasant exceptions in popular music, which, you know, in my view, popular music in a certain sense carries on the tradition. So-called modern classical music has abandoned the attempt long ago, but it
well,
is a multi-track musical
happened.
World.
Okay, so what I was saying was the campaign was terribly depressing, and especially when I thought Clinton was going to win, or might win. And what I saw happen was the crowdfund was just something very joyous for many of the people involved or working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, we got so busy on the crowdfund, it was like, I can't worry about the election now. I've got to do this thing on Bach. And what I saw was, I saw the field act. We had people who are part of networks, whether it's Giza Death Star, for your members or members of Salieri or these different networks. And they're all over the world. But they share a common desire for a human civilization, and they share
yeah.
a common desire for positive action and things working.
Yeah.
And they seem to somehow come together in the field. It was a field. It was a kind of consciousness. It was kind of like a... you know, an a non-local version of what's going on in the panhandle.
Yeah.
Is the only
yeah.
way I can describe it. And you almost felt like there were invisible forces on the other side that were saying, wait, we have some compositions that are delivered. You know, they need to be delivered, so we need this guy to learn, you know, re-practice and get on top of the organ so we can deliver them. Get it together.
Yeah, I've been it's funny you mentioned that, because I've been thinking, you know, after so many years of not having access to the organ, why does it come back now? You know, there's got to be a reason for it that will reveal itself eventually. But the interesting thing about that music, and I've said this so many times, is that, you know, I grew up with it. I was the quintessential
right.
nerd. You know, other kids are listening to the Beatles,
uh-huh.
and I'm listening to Bach. But you know, it's a multi-track music, and it really does something very peculiar once you get into the habit of mind of listening to it. It really rewires the brain to think on. You know, just playing the organ, you're constantly busy thinking about something, but
right.
it really rewires the brain. In order to think on several tracks and have it all make harmonious sense, you know, that's the other trick.
Right.
And it's something so missing from our contemporary culture and art and music and literature. It's you know, Bach is kind of like Ayn Rand. I mean, she writes this huge
right.
multi-leveled, you know, structure that every little detail plugs into something else. And we've kind of lost the ability of that, and I think that's one reason that people are so overwhelmed. So, you know, I tell them, go out and try and train yourself to listen to this music and recognize patterns and all their permutations, because it will definitely help in other ways that you can't even imagine without it.
Well, I really feel like Bach is, you know, because he had such a tragic life in many ways.
Oh, he did. Horrible.
Feeling, yeah. You have the feeling that he's saying, wait a minute, it could all work. We could have a much higher civilization with a
right.
much higher mind. And I'm not going to try and explain that to you. I'm just going to paint a picture with the music and let
right.
you feel it and be in it and see it and
right.
understand that this could really be. So, you know, here
yeah.
it is. All you have to do is just say yes and come on in.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that too. I've just done a couple of webinars on culture in my members area on my website, and that's kind of the conclusion I came to with his music. He's just sort of presenting a vision of something rather than
right.
trying to argue to it. And but it's profoundly complex music any way you slice it.
I'm happy.
You know, he's been. And it's very, ultimately it's very,
very happy
music. Yeah, it
yeah.
even when he's on a downer, it's somehow happy. You know?
Well, you know,
I
didn't realize until like, you see the manuscripts and the way he writes the note, it's like, woo!
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's, he's got this little pickup at the end. Anyway, so
he's busy.
When I guess what we're saying, whether it's the panhandle or the crowdfund, it's when good people get together and say, you know
right.
something? We don't need the truth of the tapeworm. We don't need, you know, to participate in anything evil. We just need to get together and get something wonderful done.
Right.
And when
exactly.
it works, boy, there's nothing more beautiful. Especially, you know, and all that divide and conquer, when we leave the divide and conquer behind,
right?
You know, something really gets done. And
well, when you leave it behind, when you leave it behind, you're no longer passive.
Right.
You're no longer passive. You're no longer a victim. You know, you're no longer overwhelmed by everything. You know, you just forget about it and move on. And, you know, it's Luther's old adage, well, the end of the world's tomorrow, so today I'm going to be busy planting a tree. You know, it's that attitude. So yeah, it's we need to start thinking in those terms. You know, that's kind of why I was suggesting, you
right.
know, getting together in discussion groups. You know, have friends over, just talk about things, and
yep.
you'll soon find, you know, who you have things in common with and who you don't, and everybody goes their own merry way. But you know, we're not having conversations anymore, and that's half the battle.
Well, that's why it's, you know, to me, all solutions require transparency. And
yep.
It starts with you and me bringing transparency. And I think whether, you know, there's great materials on Giza Death Star, there's great materials on Solari. I think one thing we can encourage people to do is use those materials to help them have those discussions.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, let us do some of the heavy lifting for you. And, you know, I can be the bad guy and say entrainment is happening. I'll never
yep.
forget one wonderful subscriber getting frustrated because one of his relatives had bought a overly expensive car. And I said,
no.
Well, did you warn them about the entrainment? And they said, no. And I said, well, don't blame them. Blame yourself. Because
yep.
they don't know it exists. And if they don't know it exists, they're going to get tricked.
Yep.
So, you know, and of course, this person had wanted to bring it up because they didn't want to offend, and they didn't want, you know, everybody to think they were crazy. But in fact, you know, everybody got hurt as a result. So think of this as good old-fashioned risk management. You know, we have to find a way to help people protect themselves. Anyway,
right.
Well, Joseph, it's been a great conversation. I'm always inspired by your work.
Well, thank you.
You know, I just sent someone a couple of wonderful books from my collection because I had two of, you know, I get into this thing of pre-ordering and then I end up with two or three, and so I sent them some of my extras. But, you know, I dare not ask when to expect the next one because, you know, I'm always hungry.
Well, I've been, you know, it's been difficult for me the past few months because every time I sit down to write, it's just been crazy. It's like there's been one distraction
right.
after another. But I'm hoping, say, around June to start writing on something. I may even actually start writing on something this week, and I'm hoping to have it out by the end of the year. I'm debating whether or not to go the standard publisher route or to put it up on, you know, as a self-published book on Lulu. Or something like that, maybe even Amazon, although I hate the prospect of that. But
right.
I'm really toying with the idea of doing this next one as a self-published book because I'm tired of doing all the work and having the publishers make all the money. So anyway.
Right. Well, listen, go to Giza Death Star, and if you haven't read them all, get them all. I think any... You know, if you look at our books for the year, we're always recommending one of your books, but they're wonderful books, and, you know, they're always timely, no matter what the topic. So go to Giza Death Star and get some books, and, of course, if you're a member, you get to see the vid chats. They're all,
the vid chats and the webinars as well.
Yeah. The vid chats are priceless, Joseph.
Yeah, they are. They're my social life.
Okay, well, it's been a great discussion. You have a wonderful, wonderful evening. And
you
and
too.
I know I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks for having me back on, Catherine. Bye-bye.